Hi, I'm Ted Weil. Thanks for joining me today, and welcome back to All About History, a quarterly periodical from Great Britain. So let's dive in. We're starting today in the middle of an article entitled Gangs of New York. Legends of the area's destitution began to spread, and with it, tales of violence and crime. Some accounts state that 15 murders were committed in the Five Points every night, and the old brewery was said to have been witness to one homicide a day for 15 years. However, as with many impoverished areas, it's argued that the danger of the Five Points has been exaggerated. Historian Tyler Anbinder, who worked on revising the Gangs of New York film script, was quoted by National Geographic as stating, quote, "I looked at the statistics, and other than public drunkenness and prostitution, there was no more crime in Five Points than any other part of the city," end quote. Perceived criminality aside, if the Five Points is remembered today, it is for its infamous gangs, each with their own colorful sense of dress and a formidable reputation. Quote, "Gangs offered a route of mobility, especially into politics," end quote, says Miller. "They provided outlets for young men, not teenagers, who were out of work or worked in occupations like butchers and had afternoons off after the morning markets." Unlike some gangs, many of the Five Points crews were more political in nature, and although their activity was sometimes dubious, it was not strictly criminal. They mostly engaged in turf fights with each other, serving as shoulder hitters and repeaters at elections, starting riots at elections, Miller explains. Although sometimes gang members would beat and/or rob a well-dressed man who wandered into the wrong place. However, the first gang known in the area, and perhaps even in New York itself, most certainly was criminal. The 40 Thieves began inauspiciously enough in the back rooms of a grocery store. Opened by Rosanna Piers in 1825, the store was in fact a front for an illegal bar and soon became a favorite haunt for pickpockets, crooks, and other villains. The 40 Thieves' leader, Edward Coleman, formed the gang from the best scoundrels Piers had to offer. He was notoriously tough and enforced a strict quota system. Members who were unable to return to the store with a specific value of stolen goods were quickly thrown out. Coleman had a separate business, recruiting attractive young women, known as hot corn girls, to sell corn on the street. His own wife was part of this racket, but when she consistently failed to meet her targets, he beat her to death. Coleman was hanged for his crimes in 1838, but the 40 Thieves continued. They were even said to have acquired and trained an offshoot group of child criminals, the 40 Little Thieves. As a result of the high number of immigrants in the Five Points area, many of the gangs that were formed had predominantly Irish members. One of the first of these gangs was the Roche Guard. This group was formed at the beginning of the 1850s by saloon owner Walter Roche, though some sources state their leader was in fact called Ted Roche. Legend has often stated that another Irish group, the fearsome Dead Rabbits, was formed from wayward Roche gang members. As a result, the two groups were deadly enemies. The Rabbits' distinctive name has a rather colorful history. The Dead Rabbits were said to carry a dead rabbit hanging from a pole, Miller tells us. But despite the folklore surrounding the gang, there is now a question as to whether the Dead Rabbits existed at all. Anbinder says there is little evidence that the gang existed and posits that Dead Rabbits may have been a nickname used by the Bowery Boys to demean Irish gangs. Who were the Bowery Boys? Only the most infamous of the Five Points gangs. Although the name was applied to a variety of groups at different times, they all appear to have had a nativist ideology, which was staunchly anti-immigrant and anti-Catholic. In his book, The Bowery Boys, Street Corner Radicals and the Politics of Rebellion, historian Peter Adams states that many belonged to professions such as shipbuilders, carpenters, butchers, and printers. The Bowery Boys were noted for wearing stovepipe hats and, particularly in later years, their increasingly dapper style of dress. Adams notes that a haircut described as short at the back, slicked down at the front, and with distinctive ringlets pasted down in front of the ears, known as soap locks, became a characteristic Bowery Boy look. The gangs often affected the dress, swagger, and slang of the Bowery Bohoy, a type who had become a celebrated stage character, Moza, who is an urban version of the American tall tale tradition like Paul Bunyan or Pecos Bill, says Miller. The man most associated with the Bowery Boys is without a doubt Bill the Butcher Poole, memorably portrayed by Daniel Day-Lewis in Martin Scorsese's Gangs of New York. Of the real Poole, much is shrouded in mystery, and there are a number of conflicting accounts of his life. Born on July 24, 1821, in New Jersey, Bill was 10 years old when his family moved to New York City. His father owned a butcher shop, and the young man soon followed in his footsteps. Under his rule, the Bowery Boys clashed frequently with their Irish rivals, the Dead Rabbits. Poole enforced the nativist cause during elections and became known as a particularly vicious fighter. By 1855, Poole had become the leader of the political movement, the Know-Nothings. Tom Heyer, who headed up the Know-Nothings sporting fraternity, got into an altercation with a rival political group that led to increasing animosity between them. On February 18th, this would result in Poole being shot during a bar fight. Herbert Asbury, the author of The Gangs of New York, stated, quote, Poole lived for 14 days after the shooting, to the vast amazement of his doctors, who declared vehemently that it was unnatural for a man to live so long with a bullet in his heart, end quote. But even Poole was not invincible, and on March 8th, he finally succumbed to his wounds. Purportedly, his final words were, goodbye, boys, I die a true American. Despite his notoriety, Poole was not the only leader of the Bowery Boys, and one faction, under the direction of Mike Walsh, became a political force to be reckoned with. At one point, Walsh's Bowery Boys were so powerful that they were even able to provide the bail for their leader when he was arrested and sent to jail for a second time. In 1839, Walsh's political skill paid off, and he was elected to the State Assembly. In 1843, he founded the Spartan Association, described by author Luc Santy as being equally of the political club, the fraternal order, and the gang, although it had a deliberately proletarian cast to it. The association was a formidable force that used brute strength to attack Whig headquarters and even storm the stage at Tammany Hall, one of the political centers in the city. Other Bowery Boys groups were content to protect their turf and pick fights with their enemies, the Dead Rabbits. The two gangs clashed regularly, but on July 4, 1857, they had their most infamous skirmish, resulting in a riot, 8 deaths, and hundreds of injuries. The violence began when the Dead Rabbits, or possibly members of the Roche Guard, sought to raid a clubhouse occupied by the Bowery Boys. The New York City police were, at the time, in disarray and still reeling from their own riot on June 16th. As such, the police were not dispatched. Matters were not helped when another gang, the Five Pointers, returned with the Dead Rabbits to attack a different Bowery Boys haunt the following morning. The violence continued over the following 2 days. While the Bowery Boys and the Dead Rabbits were content to engage in street violence, a new gang with an even more fearsome reputation quickly became the most prominent in the Five Points. The Wyos were formed at some point in the 1860s and dabbled in crimes far more serious than their predecessors, including prostitution, racketeering, and counterfeiting. According to Miller, they were known for communicating via a variety of bird and animal noises. In fact, the name Wyo was intended to be derived from an owl's distinctive hoo-hoo. At one point, the gang was led by Danny Driscoll and Danny Lyons. Driscoll met his end after accidentally shooting his friend Bridget Garrity, having intended to murder his rival John McGarty instead. However, the remnants of the Wyos were not kept idle for long. The enterprising Paul Kelly incorporated them, as well as any leftovers from other gangs, into a new group called the Five Points Gang. With a primarily Italian and Italian-American membership, Kelly's operation was immensely successful, and he is said to have commanded a crew of 1,500. According to historian Humbert S. Nell, this powerful gang literally controlled the area between the Bowery and Broadway, 14th Street and City Hall Park. Reputedly, among Kelly's followers was an aspiring young crook called Al Capone. Between 1898 and 1904, Kelly's gang fought for control of the area against the Eastman Gang, a predominantly Jewish gang led by Monk Eastman. Eastman was arrested, and his successor, Max Zwerbach, was later killed by the Five Points Gang. With his own gang in disarray, Kelly was pressured to keep a low profile and eventually became a labor racketeer. By now, the Five Points area itself had begun to disintegrate. In the 1890s, photographer Jacob Rees showcased the poverty of the Five Points in a series of images that shocked the general public. The most infamous area, Mulberry Bend, was demolished, and the rest of the Five Points was slowly replaced over time. Yet the legends of gangs such as the Bowery Boys and the Dead Rabbits continue to fascinate, primarily thanks to the work of one man, the aforementioned Herbert Asbury. Born in 1891, Asbury had a prolific career as a journalist before he turned to long-form writing during the 1920s. Although he dabbled in fiction, including The Devil of Pai Ling, which The New Yorker described as a gory horror show, it was for his non-fiction that he was best known. In 1928, he authored The Gangs of New York, the book that Scorsese loosely adapted into the 2002 film. Although the book certainly remains an important source, historians have pointed out that there are obvious flaws in Asbury's presentation of the facts. In an interview with Gotham Gazette, Ann Binder stated, "Asbury is very good at finding material. The problem is that he lacked judgment, so he missed obvious lies and falsehoods about the neighborhood and New York in general." Yet thanks to Asbury, the fascination with the gangs of 19th century New York City continues to this day. The hit movie, while largely fictionalized, presented these violent men to a whole new audience. Due to this and the work of numerous historians, the stories of these vicious gangs and their brutal battles continues to captivate and intrigue. Now we have two quick sidebar articles. First, draft riots. For four nights in 1863, New York City erupted into violence and bloodshed. Between July 11th to 14th, 1863, angry New Yorkers took to the streets to oppose the Civil War draft. As the bloody conflict between the North and the South raged on, New Yorkers faced new strict laws in the effort to find men to join the fight. However, affluent draftees could, for the princely sum of $300, avoid being conscripted. This caused widespread discontent among the working population. For many, $300 was an entire year's wages, and they were angered by the blatant inequality. Black people became the target of much of the violence. President Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation in September of 1862 had caused anger in New York, where some did not wish to see slavery abolished, but wanted to preserve the Union. Many, who were against the war, feared that emancipation of the slaves would cause mass unemployment among the impoverished whites in the city. What's more, as black men were not considered American citizens, they were exempt from the draft. At one point, during the carnage, a group of rioters descended on an African-American orphanage housing some 200 children. The riot was eventually quelled, and the draft went ahead as planned. The resultant damage from the disorder is said to have cost some $1,500,000. And now another follow-up, The Legend of Piker Ryan. This vicious criminal was rumored to charge $15 to chew off a man's ear. As with other gangs, legends of the Wyhos' ferocity were perpetrated by Herbert Asbury in his 1928 book, The Gangs of New York. One member of the gang, known as Piker Ryan, became infamous after he purportedly listed the prices he would charge for certain hit jobs. These ranged from punching a man for $2 to shooting them in the leg for $25. One of the most notorious was his offer to chew off a man's ear for $15. Ryan was said to have kept a list of the various attacks he had undertaken. However, as with a number of his claims, questions have been raised about Asbury's stories of Piker Ryan. For example, he includes what he claims is a picture of the notorious criminal. In fact, it's of a different gentleman, Patrick Ryan, who had nothing to do with the Wyhos. Asbury also notes that Piker Ryan was active around 1900, whereas the Wyhos are thought to have ceased operating around 1890. Perhaps most damning is the appraisal of historian John Oller, who, in Rogue's Gallery, The Birth of Modern Policing and Organized Crime in Gilded Age New York, observe, quote, "Why would a hoodlum put such an incriminating, easily memorized list in writing and keep it in his possession?" End quote. And now we move on to another feature article. This one, Murasaki Shikibu, the first novelist. Discover the mysterious Japanese noblewoman who penned a literary masterpiece. This article is written by Poppy J. St. Palmer. Since the days of the earliest civilizations, storytelling has sat at the heart of communication. From tales depicted in cave paintings and hieroglyphics and passed down through the oral tradition, all the way to the stories of television, cinema, and even viral videos and Twitter threads, storytelling is a way of understanding the world and connecting to those around us, and those living completely different lives to our own. Novels are one of the most accessible and popular methods of storytelling, but they didn't come onto the scene until the 11th century. When what is often considered to be the world's oldest novel came from an unlikely source. And like many of the world's greatest, largely anonymous innovations, it came from a woman, Japanese author Murasaki Shikibu. You'd be forgiven for not knowing Lady Murasaki's name. Even Lady Murasaki is a pseudonym, as she lived during a time when the names of women were rarely recorded. Some might say she had storytelling in her blood. Born in the city now known as Kyoto in 973, she was the daughter of a scholar and the granddaughter of a famous poet. Through her upbringing, she became very familiar with both Japanese and Chinese literature and poetry. During her lifetime, Japan was starting to become more isolated, with the looming end of missions to China, and the country began to shape a stronger national cultural identity as a result. Japanese men continued to write formally in Chinese, but it was very unusual for a woman to do so. However, Murasaki succeeded in becoming fluent in her language, and her exposure to the arts from both countries transformed her into something of a literary prodigy. Even her own academic father was shocked to learn how talented she was. She recorded his reaction in her diary. Quote, "Just my luck," he said. "What a pity she was not born a man." End quote. Murasaki's creative tendencies developed at an early age. She dabbled in poetry in her youth and used the art form to record some of her life and experiences. Her poems blessed future scholars with a look at the ins and outs of her world, despite the fact that we still don't know her true name. Throughout her early life, she had very little contact with men apart from her father. It was typical for noble women of her status to marry upon reaching puberty, but Murasaki remained in her father's household into her mid-20s, or perhaps even her early 30s. In 996, her father was posted to a 4-year governorship of Aixin Province, and Murasaki decided to accompany him. But she returned after just 2 years to marry her father's friend, Fujiwara no Nobutaka, a second cousin 20 years her senior. When they wed, Nobutaka had an unknown number of other wives, as well as various children to some of those wives. Murasaki added a daughter, Kenshi, to the brood when she was born in 999. However, Murasaki was left alone once more just 2 years later when Nobutaka died during a cholera epidemic. Many would have expected Murasaki to seek out a new partner following her husband's death, but she once again defied expectations. Instead, she began work on The Tale of Genji, a story that would come to be considered as the greatest work of Japanese literature, as well as the world's first novel. The Tale of Genji follows the life of an imperial prince in the form of a sweeping and intricate romantic saga. It was quite unlike anything anyone had ever written before. As well as telling a chronological tale of events surrounding her fictional protagonist set in the culture of the aristocracy in early Heian Japan, it also dives beneath the surface and offers deeply psychological insights into the characters' lives, something that is believed to have never been done before. Today, most novels wouldn't be complete without a peek into the inner workings of the characters, but in the 11th century, it was nothing short of genius. It is more than just a story. It is an exploration of what it means to be human. Although Murasaki's romantic lead, Genji, a handsome and sensitive courtier, is male, much of the story is told through the eyes of his female lovers. The women featured in the novel are fully multifaceted and subvert the typical roles that men and women play in high-end court culture. It reflects how women were disadvantaged and disempowered by their environment and explores the ways in which women could play the system to gain control. At the time it was written, aristocratic Japanese women were constantly shielded from public view by curtains or screens, hidden from men that weren't their fathers or husbands. The women in the tale of Genji remove those screens, if only metaphorically, by communicating with men via written poetry passed along with the help of messengers. Curious, men begin to sneak glimpses behind the screens and slowly but surely instigate sexual relationships with the mysterious women on the other side. From there, the novel explores how the women's relations to the right man alters the course of their lives. Through the tale of Genji, Murasaki offered a new look into the lives of women of her standing in a way that was both unconventional and groundbreaking. Alongside its examination of women, the tale of Genji is also admired for its portrayal of historic Japanese culture, particularly the culture shared among the country's nobility. Murasaki detailed everything from the early high-end period's clothes, styles, and entertainment to its moral code and beauties of nature. Although the tale follows intricate stories, characters, and relationships from Murasaki's marvelous imagination, her picture of high society came straight from her experiences with nobility. In 1005, Murasaki was awarded an even closer look at the upper class when her pedigree as a writer led to her being invited to work at the imperial court itself. She served as a lady-in-waiting, an occasional tutor to teenage empress Shoshi. It is unclear why exactly Murasaki was chosen for this particular role, but some believe that the young empress liked to surround herself with women of literary talent. Her other two ladies-in-waiting were revered poets Akazomi Imon and Izumi Shikibu. Always going against the grain, Murasaki took every opportunity she could to secretly teach Empress Shoshi Chinese. Now living in the setting of her own novel, she continued to write during her service and would frequently add scenes from her court life into her other written works. But unlike the romantic, sweeping story of Genji, works like The Diary of Lady Murasaki, a collection of vignettes written by Murasaki around 1008 and 1010, are starkly realistic. She wrote about more mundane events and subjects, like sordid relationships, embarrassing court members, and men that made her uncomfortable. During her tenure at the imperial court, Murasaki was surprisingly quite unpopular, likely a result of her supposedly prickly personality, and often found herself the subject of gossip and alienation. In The Diary of Lady Murasaki, she expresses her umbrage at her reputation. Quote, "Well, we never expected this," they all say. "No one liked her. They all said she was so pretentious, awkward, difficult to approach, prickly, too fond of her tales, haughty, prone to versifying, disdainful, cantankerous, and scornful. But when you meet her, she is strangely meek, a completely different person altogether. How embarrassing. Do they really look upon me as a dull thing, I wonder? I am what I am." End quote. Both the death of her husband and her unfavorable reputation meant Murasaki was no stranger to loneliness. At the imperial court, she became withdrawn and eventually retired to dedicate the rest of her life to literature and Buddhism. Her year of death is unknown, but some believe it to be 1014, making her just 41 years old when she died. Despite the scarcity of meaningful connections in her own life, her work served to connect readers of the era with a powerful, insightful look into the relationships that make us human. Her ingenious approach to storytelling undoubtedly opened up whole new worlds to the writers that came after her, making her perhaps one of the most influential contributors to literature that ever lived. and it's certainly astonishing that not only was the world's first novel a romance, and a literary masterpiece of a romance at that, it was written by a nameless woman with an extraordinary voice. We only have a few minutes left, but we do have time to dive into our next featured article. This one, The History of Zoos, From the Royal Menageries of the Past to the Zoological Gardens of Today, written by Emily Staniforth. The natural world has always been a subject of human fascination. The animal kingdom in particular has rarely been left alone by humans, with the capturing and keeping of animals a feature of many societies over the millennia. But where did the idea of seizing animals from the wild and putting them on display start? And how did this evolve into the zoos and wildlife parks that are a feature of the modern world? Some of the earliest examples of animals being acquired for a menagerie can be traced back to ancient Egypt. Evidence found at Thebes suggests that the female pharaoh Hatshepsut kept animals such as elephants, leopards, and baboons in her wildlife collection. Other exotic animal remains found in an ancient cemetery at Hierakonpolis show that although the ancient Egyptians might have enjoyed ownership of foreign pets, they did not necessarily know how to care for them properly. The skeletons of baboons and a hippo with broken bones suggest that the animals were dangerously tied up and sustained injuries while trying to free or protect themselves. But despite the animals not being well cared for, their presence was important in that the menagerie was a source of pride for the collector. It is likely that, for Hatshepsut, the existence of the menagerie and the displaying of these animals was a symbol of her wealth and status. Having access to such creatures exemplified an ability to travel and trade with foreign lands. Quote, zoos need to be understood within their wider historical contexts, explains Helen Cowie, professor of history at the University of York. Early menageries, for instance, should be viewed within the context of overseas exploration, elite entertainment, and displays of princely power, end quote. The ownership of wild and foreign animals can be seen in different examples from early history all over the world. Collections of exotic animals were first established by monarchs, who exhibited them as symbols of their power over nature, says Cowie. In the early modern period, kings sometimes organized fights between exotic animals for the entertainment of the court, or paraded their animals through the streets in grandiose processions. Using animals in fights was not a new concept, with the Romans having pitted wild beasts such as lions, elephants, bears, and alligators against each other, and sometimes people, in gladiatorial arenas. During the medieval and early modern periods, animal blood sports continued to be popular in Europe, and were a common form of entertainment up until around the 18th century. In Elizabethan England in particular, attending bear-baiting displays where bears were forced to fight each other to the death was a popular pastime. Elsewhere in Europe, the owners of menageries also used their animals to satisfy their bloodthirsty curiosity. As Cowie explains, quote, the Portuguese king Manuel I staged a fight between a rhinoceros and an elephant in Lisbon's Terreiro do Paco in 1515 to test the long-standing belief that the animals were mortal enemies. The rhinoceros was declared victor when the elephant ran away. End quote. And that, unfortunately, is all the time we have for today. Thank you for joining me for this journey through All About History. I hope you'll meet me here again next week, and we will pick up right where we left off in this article and explore more exciting tales from our past. I'm Ted Weil, wishing you all the best. Until next time.